So welcome to another lecture on quantum field theory in curved space-time. So the last time we started to discuss chapter 8, which is on the Unruh effect, which is an effect for an accelerated observer that the detector, which is accelerated, receives particles which are produced out of the vacuum, which have a thermal distribution. Yeah, and that's a key phenomenon which is used to explain Hawking radiation, which we're going to address in chapter 9 on Hawking radiation and black hole thermodynamics. So we have worked out the corresponding Rindler spacetime of an accelerated observer. And of course, we know Minkowski spacetime. And we know that we have to work out now the Bogoliubov coefficients from transforming from Minkowski spacetime to the Rindler spacetime. And if we have those Bogoliubov coefficients, then we know what kind of particles are produced and in which form. And that's where we stopped the last time. Just write down that we have now a different relation between the Bogoliubov coefficients, because now we have operators or coefficients which depend explicitly on omega, either small omega or capital omega, depending on which spacetime we're looking at. Yeah? So that the B operator in Rindler spacetime is given by an integral over omega, where omega was a Minkowski spacetime. Integrate from 0 to infinity. Yeah, we're only looking at the positive frequencies, both cases. One coefficient alpha, capital omega, small omega, operator A minus small omega minus the other coefficient beta, capital omega, small omega, operator A plus with a small omega. Yeah, so this is the relation between the operators in Minkowski spacetime and the necessary operator, the B operator, in Rindler spacetime. And we had this integral over omega. So now, if we substitute that expression in the mode expansion we had so far for Rindler spacetime and Minkowski spacetime, then we find from mode expansion, so the mode expansion gives us the following expression, 1 over square root of omega e to minus I omega u is equal to the integral from 0 to infinity of d omega prime over square root of omega prime alpha capital omega prime omega e to minus I capital omega prime u twiggle minus beta capital omega prime omega e to I omega u twiggle. Now, where did the twiggly coordinates are the coordinates in Rindler spacetime and the ordinary ones in ordinary Minkowski spacetime. So this is the relation we have, but simply by comparing the coefficients in front of the operators in the two mode expansions. And what we are after is, now we want to invert that equation so that we get an expression for alpha and beta, the Bogoliubov coefficients. And we're doing that by multiplying that equation and integrate it, and then take advantage of the normalization condition of the right-hand side, you will see shortly. So I need the next page for this. So both sides times exponential of plus minus I omega u twiggle Yeah, and by choosing different signs here, we project basically in one case, we project on the alpha coefficient and the other case on the beta coefficient. And here's a prime missing. Yeah. And this is now omega, it's not omega prime. Yeah. And then we use the condition that e to I omega minus omega prime integrated over du, of course, gives a delta distribution, so that the integral over will collapse eventually, the integral over omega prime. So let's write this up. So we have on the left-hand side 1 over square root omega, integral minus infinity to plus infinity, e to minus I omega u plus minus I capital omega u twiggle, integral over du twiggle. Yeah, so multiply this plus integrate. Integrate over u twiggle. And on the right-hand side, we get integral 0 to infinity of d omega prime divided by square root of omega prime integral plus minus infinity of du twiggle times alpha omega prime omega e to minus I omega prime u plus minus I omega u twiggle. Yeah. And a corresponding one then for beta. So this is a minus beta omega e to I omega prime u twiggle plus minus I omega u, closing brackets. Okay. So now we have this integral over omega and omega prime, yeah, and we integrate over u, and this should be actually also a u twiggle, and this should be also a u twiggle, this one here. Yeah, we integrate over u twiggle, have the e to I omega prime minus omega. This gives a delta distribution, so the integral collapses over u and gives a 2 pi delta omega minus omega prime. So this gives an integral 0 to infinity d omega prime over omega prime. And as the whole thing collapses, here we see basically these coefficients here collapses. This was exactly the construction we did, so that the right-hand side collapses and that we just have the coefficients standing there, nothing else. So this gives, depending on the sign, plus or minus sign, we get the plus. For the plus sign, we get the plus alpha omega prime omega. And in the other case, for the minus sign, we get the minus beta star omega prime omega. Yeah, and a 2 pi times a 2 pi delta omega minus omega prime. Okay. 2 pi. Yeah, so also this integral collapses, and at the end of this calculation, we just have a 2 pi divided by square root omega prime, and we have a plus alpha omega omega omega, or a minus beta omega omega star. Good. So now we have the desired expression that we have the coefficients are now given by this integral on the left-hand side. So all we need to do is now to evaluate this integral. Of course, this is a complex integral, and we have to do some contour integration in the complex plane to figure out the value of this integral. So as a summary, so alpha, omega, omega, or beta, omega, omega, is given by plus minus 1 over 2 pi, square root of capital omega divided by small omega, and then this integral du Twickel e to plus minus I omega u plus omega u Twickel. There's I missing. So now we have to express u as a function of u Twickel. So this gives the integral plus minus 1 over 2 pi, square root of capital omega over small omega, integral from minus infinity to plus infinity du Twickel of an exponential of I omega u Twickel plus minus an I omega over a, yeah, where a is the acceleration, times e to minus a u Twickel. Yep. Okay. So now we replace or we change the variables. So we define a new integration variable x, which is defined as e to minus a u Twickel. So then dx over du Twickel is just minus a e to minus a u Twickel, and this is just minus a times x. Furthermore, we define a function, the function which is given by small omega and capital omega, which is defined as 1 over 2 pi a, integral dx, x to the power of minus I omega over a minus 1, times an exponential of I omega over a times x. Yeah, this function is basically just this integral here with some prefactor in terms of the new variable x. Now this looks somehow familiar, maybe. So we have some power here and we have an exponential here. We can recast this actually in the form of Euler's gamma function. So Euler's gamma function, defined now for complex arguments, gamma of s is an integral from 0 to infinity over dt, t to the power of s minus 1, and e to minus t. Yeah, you see the structure here. We can recast this here as t and this power here as s. So we set now t equal b times x with, and then this integral from 0 to infinity dt dx, x to the power of s minus 1, e to minus bx, is then given by b to the power of minus s times gamma of s. Yeah. And that we can rewrite as an exponential of minus s logarithm of b times gamma of s. Yeah, note that S and B are can be complex, and in fact here in our case they are complex. B and S is complex. So here we have actually that B is minus I omega over A plus an epsilon. We introduce here an epsilon because we're running over a pole if we don't do so, and then at the end let go epsilon go to zero. Let me first define S. So S is minus I omega over A plus an epsilon, where epsilon is larger than zero and epsilon goes to zero plus if we're taking the limit. Yeah, otherwise if epsilon would be zero, we have this 1 over x like behavior, so we are running over a pole. So now we can calculate the logarithm of this one, the log of b. But here we need to be careful because we need to take into account also the special case that we have here, a complex argument of the logarithm. So we get a solution which depends on the proper choice of the phase. So log of b then is given by the limit epsilon going to zero plus of the logarithm of minus I omega over A plus epsilon. Yeah. Let's do this. And for the logarithm of a complex number, we will get the arctangens of B over A. Let's write it down. So as a side remark, if we have the logarithm of A plus E B, we can write it as a logarithm of the absolute value of A plus I B plus I times the sine of B times arctangent of absolute value of B over A. Yeah, this gives us the phase. Yeah. And A shall be larger than zero. So if we use that, then we find that this is given as the logarithm of the absolute value of omega over A. Yeah. Minus I times pi half of the sine of omega over A. Good. Yeah, in principle, and in principle, you see that the argument is a complex number. There's no real part to it, so it automatically it appears that we just have the same expression for the sine here, sine b, and this drops out if you take the proper limit epsilon to zero plus, and just gives the phase pi half. Yeah. So then we can write down now the full solution. Yeah, this is just a gamma function, this integral. We just have calculated the prefactor. So the full solution looks like that. Let me write down something else. Actually, if you look at this one here, it depends on the sine of omega over A, the whole thing. And if you look at the integrals we have for alpha and beta, there's just a sine difference of omega. Yeah, so in one case, we get a minus sign here for that phase, in the other case, we get the plus sign for the phase. And the rest is the same, basically. The integral is the same for the alpha and beta coefficients. That means we have this following relation, which follows out of this, that this function f of omega capital omega is just given by the function of minus omega capital omega times an exponential of pi capital omega divided by a. And this if definition is up there, this was just a gamma function. We get this extra factor here of the sine of pi half. This gives a total factor pi. And this goes actually like the logarithm. This is the logarithm of b, and we have to take the exponential of the logarithm of b times s, where s is omega over a. So this gives the factor exponential of pi capital omega over a. Yeah, this is where it comes about. So, and this is actually all we need. In fact, we can stop here and continue. We don't need to write down the explicit formula of that function capital F. This phase factor here at the end turns out to be the decisive factor which determines the spectrum of the unruh radiation. So this is the factor which gives the thermal radiation for the accelerated observer. Yeah, but let's continue and write down also the full solution. Just for completeness, so the full solution is, now I need some more space, f of omega capital omega is given by 1 over 2 pi a exponential of I capital omega divided by a logarithm of the absolute value of omega over a plus pi half times omega over a, the sine of omega over a, times the gamma function of minus I capital omega over a. Yeah, this is just the prefactor minus s log b, and this is the gamma function of s. So we can write now the full solution. So the one Bockel-Jubach coefficient alpha capital omega omega is given by the square root of capital omega over omega times that function f of omega capital omega, and the beta of capital omega omega is then just minus capital omega over omega to the power of a half times that function of minus omega capital omega. Yeah, taking the absolute values, then alpha squared omega omega, and this should be the absolute value squared, is then just omega over omega, absolute value of that function f squared, and the same for the coefficient beta. So beta capital omega omega squared is then just capital omega over omega, absolute value of f minus omega omega squared. Now we have this nice relation between these different f functions here, which gives us this factor, just the exponential. Yeah. So we can rewrite alpha in forms of beta. So alpha capital omega omega squared is just the absolute value of beta omega omega squared times this factor now squared, which gives an exponential of 2 pi omega over a. Good. So everything is in place, and now we can calculate the occupation numbers and the unruh temperature. 8.5 occupation numbers. Oops. So let's calculate the expectation numbers of the B particles in Minkowski vacuum. So these are the particles which are seen emerging from the Minkowski vacuum. So expectation value of B particles in Minkowski vacuum. Yeah, so we have the expectation value of the number operator of capital omega. And this we define as the vacuum in Minkowski space times the operator B plus B minus in Rindler space, acting on the vacuum in Minkowski space. Yeah, the usual procedure. Now let's plug in what we have for these operators in terms of the Bogoliubov coefficients. So this is given by the Minkowski vacuum times the integral d omega of alpha star capital omega omega a hat plus omega minus b star omega omega times the a hat minus omega. Times, now the other operator, times integral d omega prime of alpha omega omega prime a hat plus omega prime minus beta omega omega prime a hat minus omega prime. And plugging everything together and using, again, the orthogonality relation we had for the coefficients, we get this is then just given by integral d omega, absolute value of beta omega omega squared. Yeah, so the A plus operators basically drop out, and also the mixed terms drop out, and the only term which remains are just the product of those terms here. I'm sorry, this should be a minus sign, this should be a plus sign. Good. Now we have also the normalization condition. So in the previous chapter, we have seen that alpha squared minus beta squared is 1. And in our case, the coefficients have this explicit omega dependence. So the normalization condition here reads that if we have this integral d omega times absolute value of alpha omega omega squared minus beta omega omega squared, that gives a delta. Yeah. So you see this normalization condition only works if we have another integral for the volume, for example. And otherwise this does not make sense. Yeah. Omega, omega, yep. So, and if we use this relation and plug it in the expression we have here, this gives the following. This gives the integral of d omega 0 to infinity Yeah, all these integrals go from 0 to infinity. Beta of capital omega omega squared times, yeah, and now we use this relation we have down here. Alpha squared is beta squared times this exponential. We plug it in this relation here. So this gives an exponential of 2 pi omega over a minus 1 is equal delta of 0. Now you see that this factor here does not depend on omega, so we can put it on the right-hand side. So we find that this integral over d omega over the absolute value of beta omega omega squared is just the inverse of this factor times this delta of 0. So this occupation number operator is just given by integral d omega beta omega omega squared, and this is just given by an exponential of 2 pi capital omega over a minus 1 to the power of minus 1 times delta of 0. Now we argued before that this delta basically is just a place, just a marker for the volume. So if we integrate over the volume, this gives us the volume itself. So if you put it formally on the right-hand side, what we have is just the number density, yeah, and then the number density n of omega. So the number of produced particles, if we define this as the expectation value of the number operator divided by the volume, then this is given by an exponential of 2 pi capital omega over a minus 1 to the power of minus 1. And this is the final result, that the particles produced follow this distribution. And to recall immediately that this distribution is just like a Bose-Einstein distribution function. If we replace now a over 2 pi with the temperature, yeah? And this is the unruh temperature. T is equal a over 2 pi distribution function. Yeah? And this is the unruh temperature. We can call it U if you want. TU is the unruh temperature of the spectrum of reduced particles. Yeah? So note that this is just, we just calculated the spectrum of particles. There's no assumption about thermalization or thermodynamics or bulk matter. We just compared the vacuum in Rindler space-time and in Minkowski space-time, computed the Bogoliubov coefficient, and find that this spectrum of reduced particles has the form of a Bose-Einstein distribution function if we declare the acceleration of a 2 pi as something like a temperature, which determines the shape of this produced particle spectrum. And this temperature, or this temperature parameter is the unruh temperature. So it looks like a thermal distribution, although of course it is not in a thermal equilibrium, but it looks like a thermal distribution, the unruh temperature. Good. So let me make some closing remarks to the unruh temperature. And then we have a small break and continue with the next chapter. So first of all, I need some space. So n omega is a Bose-Einstein distribution function. Bose-Einstein distribution. With a temperature T is the unruh temperature, which is defined as A over 2 pi. Yeah, and this is the unruh effect. So the accelerated, what it means, so if we have an accelerated observer sitting inside a rocket which is accelerating, this detector or that observer sees particles as coming from a thermal bath. But of course, they are not coming from a thermal bath. They just have the distribution as if they are coming from a thermal bath. Actually, in astrophysics, we have many examples where we have occupations of some states where we define then a temperature which describes the occupation of these states. But we are perfectly aware that the whole system is not in thermal equilibrium. Yeah, so this is a notion which is well known from astrophysics and might be sometimes a little bit new to students who are just have been learning thermodynamics and statistical mechanics, but this is a concept you find on many places. So one can do the same exercise we did actually for not for scalar particles, but also for Dirac particles. Yeah. Then, of course, one has a different statistics. And what is happening is that the whole thing goes through, but there's a sign change in the Bogle, coming from the Bogle-Yubov coefficients in a normalization. And what you find is that that you now have not commutation, but anti-commutation relations. What you find is that this sign changes here. Instead of a minus one, we have a plus one. So for fermions, we get an affirmative Dirac distribution of particles. So for spin a half particles, fermions, one finds actually a Fermi Dirac distribution. So what is the unruh temperature in SI units? In SI units. So we need a K Boltzmann here times T is an H bar over C. A over 2 pi. Yeah. And so from that one finds that the temperature is 1 Kelvin times an acceleration of 2.46 times 10 to 20 meter per second squared. Yeah, so if the observer is accelerating with 2.46 times 10 to 20 meter per second squared, then one finds a temperature of 1 Kelvin. Now this acceleration is huge, right? So on Earth we have 9.8 meter per second squared. Even if you go on the surface of a neutron star, yeah, this is much higher, this acceleration. However, such kind of accelerations can happen if we fall into a black hole, actually, for an outside observer. And that exactly is the relation between the unruh temperature we have here for an accelerated observer and the thermal radiation we see from a black hole. So there's some historical note, which I just mentioned. So this effect was worked out fully by unruh in the mid-70s. However, it was noticed first also by Fulling a few years earlier. It was already calculated by Davis, but finally explained by unruh, and therefore it's called the unruh effect. So this closes the section 8. If you have any questions or comments, then please post it in the forum. And after a short break, after cleaning the blackboard, we start with the final chapter 9 on the Hawking effect and thermodynamics of black holes. So let's continue with chapter 9, Hawking effect and thermodynamics of black holes. Hawking radiation. Let us discuss some simple notion or concept which stands behind Hawking radiation from the viewpoint that now we're discussing a quantum effect. Yeah. If you go back to the unruh effect was basically, yeah, you have an accelerated observer. There was just a flat space-time or conformally flat space-time, if you want, in Rindler space-time, but there was basically no curvature visible. And there is, of course, I mentioned that by going to Rindler space-time, we have the appearance of a horizon. And the appearance of a horizon is also the key feature for the quantum effect we see here. And the quantum effect, of course, in the unruh effect comes into the game that we're talking about, the scalar particles and the Bogoyurov transformations. Yeah. And here for the Hawking radiation, we also have a quantum effect, and we also have a horizon. And the horizon is the key aspect we need here. Yeah, so if we have some horizon here, this is the black hole on that side, and now we have a simple picture, we have a virtual black hole. So out of the vacuum, within the Heisenberg uncertainty relation, we can have virtual pairs of particles, virtual particles which appear when we look closer into the vacuum and we emerge again, and then there are some other vacuum fluctuations which can appear and re-emerge again. Yeah? So forward, backward particles and antiparticles which appear here. You might have seen this picture before. Now, if this vacuum fluctuation is happening close to the horizon is a dividing surface which tells you, okay, once the particle is outside, there is the possibility that the particle stays outside. But once the particle goes over the horizon, inside the horizon, it cannot go back. So this virtual pair cannot recombine anymore. Yeah. Unless this particle also goes in the horizon. But if the wavelength of these particles here is large enough to escape, go outside, then basically from this quantum fluctuation, one particle goes outside and the other particle goes inside, beyond the horizon, and goes into the black hole. Now it turns out if you look at the kinematics of those two particles, this particle here inside actually has negative energy, and that one has positive energy. So this actually, this is a particle with a virtual particle which contributes negative energy to the black hole, and a positive energy particle goes out, thereby balancing overall energy conservation. Yeah? So the black hole will lose mass by capturing that negative energy particle and releasing energy by emitting this other particle, positive energy. So the energy is here positive, and the energy is here negative. The energy in terms of the particle, so this is just the energy of that particle. That's not the total energy of the system. And thereby, we can define that on that basis. Yeah. So we have a virtual pair at horizon. At the horizon. Particle inside horizon plus one outside, which escapes. And we can give a simple estimate. This is basically just an order of magnitude check. So what we just look at the problem and see what are the relevant scales of the problem. The relevant scales is we look at the de Broglie wavelength of that virtual particle. Yeah, so we have an energy which basically is given by h bar c over the Schwarzschild radius. So, and if this energy is smaller than that, then the particle can escape. Yeah, if the energy is smaller than that, it means the wavelength is larger than the Schwarzschild radius, and then it can escape. So lambda is larger equal to Schwarzschild radius. Yeah. So this means the particles which escape have this typical temperature and larger. So this means the typical temperature scale, typical energy or temperature, is given by h bar c over the Schwarzschild radius. And that is then just given by h bar c cubed over 2gm, where 2gm over c squared is the Schwarzschild radius. So this, the expectation is, this again is just dimensional reasoning, and therefore it is quite powerful, although the arguments seem to be very, very simple. The temperature should be on the scale of 1 over gm. That's our expectation in natural units. Yeah? And by dimensional reasoning, it should not be much different. The mass of the black hole is the only scale which appears, so the temperature has to be 1 over the mass, basically, just by dimensional reasoning with some prefactor. So in order to discuss the Hawking effect, we need to discuss now the space-time we have for a black hole. So we need to discuss the Schwarzschild coordinates. Again, in a system where we can make a proper transformation to flat space-time, and that we again do in some coordinates where we have to look basically at the full possible solution for the Schwarzschild solution. So the Schwarzschild solution actually is only valid outside the horizon. But we can extend it also inside the horizon with using tortoise coordinates, and we can extend it even more. And the full extension of the full solution, the full coordinate system we have for black holes, static black holes, are the Kruskal-Jegerus coordinates, and that we need to discuss. So let's start with the Schwarzschild solution. and go from there. The Schwarzschild metric is ds squared is 1 minus 2m over r, small r. dt squared minus 1 minus 2m over r to the power of minus 1 dr squared minus an r squared d omega squared. So here we use h bar is equal c is equal g is equal 1. These are geometrical units. H bar c equal 1 are natural units. If you put also g equal 1, which is quite often done by relativists, then we just have 2m over r as the appropriate term in the coefficient of the Schwarzschild metric. So now we're going to 1 plus 1 dimensional, and we assume that ds squared is now 1 minus rg over r dt squared minus 1 minus rg over r to minus 1 dr squared. And this is basically now an assumption, so we make the ansatz, we're just working in 1 plus 1 dimensions, and then the metric shall have that form, period. And where rg equal to m is the gravitational radius. That's the same reasoning we had also for the Anwu effect. Once we are working in 1 plus 1 dimension, everything is conformally flat, and we can use the methods we use for the Anwu temperature. We can just export it here for the Hawking radiation. So we introduce now tortoise coordinates. Tortoise coordinates, in quotation marks, are r star of r, which we define again, dr star is equal dr over 1 minus rg over r. Then we can write this r star of r as being an r minus rg minus an rg, let's do it like this, minus an rg times the logarithm of r over rg minus 1. And that is equation star. Yeah. So r star we can extend now to plus minus infinity if r is larger than rg. We can rewrite a metric now in this tortoise coordinates here using that expression. And then the metric looks like the following. So then we have a ds squared is given by a 1 minus rg over r, where r depends on r star, times a dt squared minus a dr squared. So here we see really that we have a conformally flat metric. Yeah. This is just the flat part, and we have a prefactor, which is the conformal factor. And we can recast this in light cone coordinates. Light cone coordinates, ds squared is given by
1 minus Rg divided by R as a function of R star times du Twickel dv Twickel, where now u Twickel is T minus R star and the v Twickel is a T plus R star.
Good. Okay, so far these are just Schwarzschild coordinates and tortoise coordinates. If you want to have the full diagram, the full coordinate system, we're going to another coordinate system which is called the Kruskal-Chegaris coordinate system.
Kruskal-Chegaris coordinates. And this system really describes the whole space-time.
So we rewrite our equation we have here, equation star.
So we rewrite star that we take the exponential on both sides and multiply it with Rg over R. Then we find the following equation, 1 minus Rg over R is given by Rg over R exponential of 1 minus Rg over R exponential of V Twickel minus U Twickel over 2 Rg. And that is our equation, double star. We can look at the metric. Now, if we rewrite it in that form, the metric looks like this. Ds squared is equal to Rg over R exponential 1 minus Rg over R exponential minus U Twickel over 2 Rg exponential of plus V Twickel over 2 Rg du Twickel dv Twickel.
So now we define new coordinates by basically combining these exponentials with the du Twickel and dv Twickel here, so that we have just this prefactor left here. And these are actually the Kruskal-Chegaris light cone coordinates.
Chegaris light cone coordinates.
So we define that U is equal to minus 2 Rg. This prefactor is just for convenience. Exponential of minus U Twickel over 2 Rg. And the same for V. So V is defined as, now with the plus sign, 2 Rg exponential of V Twickel over 2 Rg. So then the metric looks a little bit simpler. So then the ds squared is equal an Rg over R, which depends now on this new coordinates u and v, exponential of 1 minus R of u and v over RG du dv. Now, if you look at this metric, there's only one singular term left, and this is this 1 over R factor here. We know in Schwarzschild coordinates R equals 0 is a true singularity, and the other one, when R is equal to RG, is just the definition of the horizon in the Schwarzschild metric. But in this case, it is not singular anymore. So we have found the coordinate system where we get rid of this quasi-singularity at the horizon and just have this one true singularity left. So this is regular at R equals RG. Yeah? So the only singularity is at R equals 0. So now let us relate this u and v coordinates to t and r coordinates we had before. Relation of coordinates. And here we're using equation double star to infer that u times v is a minus 4 RG squared exponential of an R star over RG, and that is a minus 4 RG squared R over RG minus 1 exponential of R over RG minus 1. And u over v squared is just an exponential of 2t over rg. Now, if we define it in that way and just use the definition we had before for r and t, we do not cover all possible combinations of u and v. So what we're doing is now we adopt this form of the metric and extend the coordinates now not only from the validity range we have for these relations, but for the whole plane. So we extend it to plus minus infinity. Extend to minus infinity to plus infinity. And also for the other coordinate v. Yeah? And the black hole horizon is actually located at the point where u or v are zero. Black hole horizon is now located when r is equal to rg. And this means when u is equal to 0 or v is equal to 0. Aha, so we have two solutions for the black hole horizon now. Either u is equal to 0 or v is equal to 0. So in this extended coordinate system, which is still a full solution of GR, yeah, we find now two horizons. And basically, these are the horizons when we set t to plus or t to minus infinity. T is plus minus infinity. So either for plus infinity, we get actually the usual black hole horizon. For minus infinity, this actually is something like an inverted black hole horizon, and it is labeled not as a black hole horizon. It's not a second black hole horizon. It's actually the horizon of a white hole horizon.
So
now these Kruskal-Chekhov coordinates in the Lycorn system can be, of course, then restructured in terms of a time-like and space-like coordinate capital T and R.
And if we have that, we can start drawing a diagram sort for time-like and space-like coordinates. We define that U is now a capital T minus R, and that V is a capital T plus R.
Yeah. Good. So I'm going to draw a diagram of the Kruskal-Chekhov coordinate. So just look a little bit more now at the hypersurfaces, where R is equal constant.
So the hypersurfaces where R is equal constant, hypersurfaces of R equal constant.
This is according to this relation we have here. This relation only depends on R, so this means if R is constant, then U times V is constant.
So U times V, and this is just T squared minus R squared.
So these are hyperbola again. Yeah, here we find the hyperbolas again.
When R is larger than RG, then UV is negative, and these are time-like. And if R is smaller than RG, we have a change of the sign. UV is positive, and these are space-like coordinates.
If T is equal constant, now T only appears in this relation here, then U over V squared is constant. This means U over V is equal constant, and these are just straight lines. Good. So let's draw a diagram. Versus T and R. T and R. So first we can draw the line for U and V being equal to zero. These are just lines 45 degrees. So we have one here and one here. Yeah, in this case here, U is equal to zero, and here V is equal to zero. These are the horizons. So then we have the singularity. Actually, the singularity should be red. Anyway, I will paint it green. We have the at r equals zero. We have the singularity. Now r equals constant means that we have this hyperbola structure. So these are hyperbolas up here. came up here for t plus minus infinity. Yeah? So here we have r equals 0 and then r equals 0, and this is a singularity. The true singularity. So, and then we have paths, and then we have paths where r is equal constant, but time-like. This is a space-like hyperbola, and that all the time-likes are in here or in here. Yeah, so we have r equal constant. Actually, we have different hyperbolas going down here. Similarly, in the case when we discussed Rindler spacetime and an accelerated observer. Yeah, we also had this hyperbola structure. Looks very much like we discussed before. So we see that we have four different regions in this spacetime diagram. So if we look at ordinary Schwarzschild coordinates, we actually only cover this part here. Yeah. If we go into tortoise coordinates, we can also cover now the region in here, up here. But now going to the Kruskal-Czekeres coordinate, we realize that we also have an asymptotically flat spacetime not only here, which is asymptotically flat, but also here. It's just mirrored in this way. Yeah? So we have a mirror in that direction. So here we also have an asymptotically flat spacetime. So r equal constant is also going up here. R equal constant. Lines are here. That's also an asymptotically flat spacetime. So what's the singularity here? The singularity is t at t equal minus infinity. So any particle which emerges from this singularity at t minus infinity going on space-like, on time-like trajectories has to go in this direction. Actually, they have to go through the horizon. So the particles have to go through the horizon. And they cannot go back to the singularity. So basically, this is a white hole. It spits out particles. No particle can enter a white hole. It's the other way around. Every particle has to leave a white hole. So it's something like an anti-black hole. A black hole sucks everything in, and a white hole spits everything out. So this is a white hole. How do we label a white hole? White hole should be white. I don't have black, so anyway. So this is a white hole, actually. And this is the black hole up here. Actually, there's nothing in here. It's just a labeling that everything in here belongs to the white hole and everything in here belongs to the black hole. Yeah. Of course, there's nothing down here. It stops at r equals 0. Good. Two horizons, two asymptotic, two black holes and two white holes, yeah. In principle, you can say there are two black holes and two white holes. From this side of the black hole, you will see there's this black hole and this white hole. From the other side, you also see a black hole and a white hole. So to say, you can say that you have here a black hole and here a black hole and here a white hole and here a white hole. But it basically is described by the same singularity here. This is r equals 0. This is one point, basically, right? R equals 0. Okay. Maybe something in addition. This point here, basically, one could enter from this conformal space-time to this from this space-time to this space-time. Now we did it in a conformal space-time. You can extend the Kruskal-Czekeres coordinates also to 1 plus 3 dimensions, and then you would find that actually each point we have in this two-dimensional diagram has a substructure, a sub-two-dimensional structure from the missing two angles, d omega, which are everywhere here. And then you figure out that in principle there's a connection here because you're missing these other two dimensions where you can go from one space to the other one. And that is actually a tunnel where you can go from one space to the other. Good, so in the last 5 minutes, let me just draw the conformal diagram. And then we stop here and calculate the Hawking effect in the next lecture. So first. Now I got a terminology. This is a wormhole solution we can have here. So the wormhole solution appears already in the Kruskal-Chekhov coordinate, the connection between the two asymptotically flat space-time. Good. Let's go to the conformal diagram. So the procedure is the same. We're going to coordinates with finite ranges. So we have kappa is equal arctangent of u and the nu, which is an arc tangent of v, and then the kappa goes from minus pi half to plus pi half, and the same for nu. Nu goes from minus pi half to plus pi half, and these are now bounded space-like and time-like coordinates. We can draw a diagram how this looks like in these new coordinates, how the structure looks like. So in terms now of eta and chi, where kappa is equal eta minus chi, and nu is equal eta plus chi. So the structure looks like this. Again, we have light rays at 45 degrees. As it is usual in these conformal diagrams, all the light rays have plus 45 or minus 45 degrees. Now the whole thing is bounded. So if you go to infinity, we reach a line, a finite at a finite distance, and also here. And this has something like a diamond structure. We have the singularity now again is on this parabola, where we have the singularity. Usually is denoted by a wiggly line, but in reality, you know, this is just one point, r equals 0, again here. And we have characteristic points. Again, we have the conformally flat space-time here. We have the conformally flat space-time here, and another one here. We have the crossing point here, where we have the wormhole connecting the two. We have the black hole here and the white hole down here. It's exactly the same as there, but not but now bounded. And these points have a special meaning. We have here an I plus, and another I plus, and an I minus, and an I minus. And here we have an I zero and an I zero as special points here, 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 and here. So these I's are the future and past time-like infinities and space-like infinities. So I plus. Future time-like infinity. So capital T goes to infinity and R is finite. And the I minus then is the future, is the past time-like infinity, where now t goes to minus infinity and r is finite. Then we also have a space-like infinity. So I zero, this here is the space-like infinity. Here r goes to infinity, capital R goes to infinity, t is finite. Yeah, and the same here for this one. We have two of those. And we have now also these boundary lines here and here. And these boundary lines are ascri plus and ascri minus. And here ascri plus and ascri minus, this one here. Yeah. And these are the null infinities, so all the light rays, they emerge at some point, but they all stop here. All the light rays are bounded here, either in this direction or in this direction. So these are the future null infinities. So this is the future null infinity for light rays. Yeah. And this is the past null infinity. Past null infinity. Plus, and then we have the past infinities, the null infinities here. Good. Okay. Good. So I will stop here with this conformal diagram. Let me just draw the singularities we have here. These are also special points. Here we have the singularity, as you know. Okay, so what we discussed so far was basically the same discussion we had before for Rindler space. Now we have explored in full glory the Schwarzschild coordinates and the maximal extension to the Kruskal-Chekhov coordinates to really see the full space-time structure of black holes or the Schwarzschild solution in general relativity. So we have the structure that we have this white hole and the black hole and two asymptotically flat regions. We recover again that we have this parabolic shape if r is equal constant, and we have the appearance of the horizon. So if you look at this side only, this looks very much like Rindler space. And as it turns out, we can very much transport over the concepts and calculations we did for Rindler space-time now to this Kruskal-Chekhov coordinate system, or the Kruskal space-time, and then calculate what is the temperature seen by an observer in the space-time due to the appearance of this horizon here. Yeah, this horizon emerges now from the curvature of space-time. In Rindler space-time, it emerges by the notion that we have an accelerated observer. How these two connect to each other with the black hole, we will see then in the next lecture, which is the last lecture of this course. And there we will also discuss then, in addition to Hawking radiation, the notion of black hole thermodynamics, that we can assign a black hole not only a temperature but also an entropy, and make similar considerations as in thermodynamics, so that you can somehow say that we have a first law of black hole thermodynamics and a second law of black hole thermodynamics. So everything else will appear in the next lecture, in the final lecture. If you have any questions so far about the Unruh effect or the Kruskal diagram, so please post it on the forum, and we see each other then next week. So next week we will also have a question and answer session again before the lecture starts, where we'll also discuss the evaluation, which is just happening today. I hope everybody has been using the evaluation and providing feedback to the course. So thank you for listening.